side 2 of session number 66, February 23rd, 2009. This thing about metaphysical isolation and then the creation of group mind through human-made technologies, I've often said that if you believe there's life before death, then okay, if you believe that there's some souls, and they come in this world to work with some soul issues, soul problems, and hook up with somebody or do something with some people, sabotage people or mate with people or get personal, that's the soul purpose, soul journey. Comes into a world where the artifacts made by that world, meaning humans, become language and environments, confuse the soul's situation. So I would say the word soul can refer to the metaphysical isolation. That sense of metaphysical isolation comes into a world that is indifferent to the soul, is doing the work of human-made environments or second nature, and then the soul dies and leaves, and the second nature world flows on. And then the souls perhaps reincarnate to work out other soul problems, solve their metaphysical isolation, or their sense of not being at one with the divine or something. And they come and work on their divine problems, and it gets all mixed up with the group mind. It becomes a question of how deep the group mind is, and brain research is going to have to deal with this. How much is consciousness external, and what is it made up of, and where, how far deep in the brain it goes. And that should remind you of the debate that's ongoing about what is, how much can a person become a chip-implanted cyborg? Like Blade Runner raised that question. That is the issue, and if people acknowledge that we survive death, that would throw a whole new effect on the effects of second nature and language itself, which seems to operate on fear. People create words to fill up void, and then they create artifacts to fill up time. So if there was a change on the metaphysical isolation principle, I don't know if it would solve the metaphysical isolation if people believe that they survived death. But it might have some influence in a loosening up of the fear of death. Then would they come back into the situation more conscious?
Hard to say. You know, I think if you ask a lot of people, if there was no God, or if you didn't think you lived after you lived, would you change your behavior? And most people would say, no, I'd still go to work the next day and still behave the same way I do towards my peers. Like, I wouldn't suddenly change my attitude.
Yeah. And now, there's no basis for what I'm going to say. It can't be proven, but the evergreens say that in 100 years, everybody will believe in reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And they see the world really in a better place in 100 years. You know, with cold fusion, all these things, no
right.
Starvation,
right.
Health taken care of. I don't know if they would say, they didn't say this, that knowing about reincarnation will help make the situation more relaxed.
Well, people will feel a little more responsible for their actions and the repercussions of what they do, possibly, and that there be the possibility of retribution and karma, I suppose.
Well, the Aryans did say in dealing with that topic that there is the problem that if people believe they'll survive death, they actually get more reckless.
Mm.
And they said that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So if we did change in...
What, they think, oh, fuck it, I'll just do it and get it right the next time around.
Yeah, or just say, well, I'll kill that guy, doesn't matter. He'll come back.
Right. Yikes.
Yikes. So let's say in 100 years it's a better world. Would the Thompson Quadrant people say, oh, it's because we overcame the fear of death.
Mm.
The McLuhan people say, no, technology changed us. LaRouche would say, it wasn't just technology, it was a particular one, cold fusion. And then Croker would say, nah, it never got better. We're going cyborg.
Mm.
So we look back, and we could take those four different views of what caused the change, which gets the most benefit for the change. I remember being at William Irwin Thompson's classes, lectures, and there was a regular there, and he used to always yell out, well, the problem is people's afraid of death. If we weren't afraid of death, we'd be better situation. Like, he really harped on it.
Hmm.
And I don't know if it'd be that simple. Because
mm-hmm.
The soul overcomes its metaphysical isolation, solving the problem whether it survives death or not, but it still has to deal with the confusion caused by language and media.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that confusion gets alleviated slightly with cold fusion.
Mm.
So, Scott, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, the flip side of the issue of reincarnation is something that you've pointed out the Evergreens have said, which is that we come here to get away from the pain of the confusion on the other side, because the problem is too big to handle. So we come here to have us to deal with the problem at a lower, a smaller level where we can cope with it better. So
create a frame, create a limited game, and then play within those rules.
Mm.
Like, you know, the Evergreens told us that when someone gets murdered, the person who murdered them, when they eventually die, they meet the person they murdered and they shake hands because they set up that dilemma or that operation so they can experience being murdered and being a murderer. The whole thing is you come here to have a limited...
I find that so unlikely that some mother of three kids get murdered and their kids' fucking lives are miserable. I doubt she's going to shake the hands of the people that murdered them. You know, if Marshall McLuhan was murdered, I doubt he's going to, like, when the other people come, he's going to go, thanks for murdering me, so I get to, like, you know, watch all these people that I was really loved and connected to live shitty lives because of that. I doubt it.
Okay, from human consciousness, but the area you say you have totally different consciousness in the dead zone.
True that.
And you see all the many lives, and that's just one trivial little life.
Right.
And you don't have that emotional identification that you're laying out, which is natural when you're inside this world.
Mm-hmm.
And
how do you know? How do you know that people still don't carry that kind of bag? What about all these good...
No, I'm just quoting the unknowable, right. The Evergreens.
From what people say, you know, ghosts and hauntings and that kind of thing, it would suggest that, no, these issues carved deep and not resolved when you die.
Yeah, and I don't know what the Evergreens would say about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they're ghosts, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How about this one? The Evergreens, I asked them... So following the line of reasoning that people come here to experience, just have different kinds of experiences.
Mm.
From the soul plane, it said, boy, I'd love to have that thing. See what it's like to be murdered. So they come in with a detached attitude with it. But once they're in here, then they're all within the fearful human limited dimension.
Mm.
So I said, so all those people that Pol Pot killed, those millions, they reincarnated in that place in Cambodia so that they could experience that?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone said yes, as either they said paranoid or as horrible as it sounds, that's actually what happened.
Hmm.
Now, that'd be hard. That's impossible for humans from this perspective to believe.
It's also kind of hard to believe that there's 3 million souls hanging around going, let's all fucking die all at once. I just find that. I suppose all those Jews, too, in the Second World War, they're like, yeah, let's fucking reincarnate. This is a good time.
It's a good time for us to have a
good
mad
time to, yeah, really experience fucking horrible trauma. Because it's just so nice up here, so we got to go down there to the shitty zone. I just don't buy it. I'm sorry. Not only that, it's also like just numerically speaking, you know, now we've got billions of people on the planet, but human population hasn't been that big up until about 150 years ago. So, I mean, how do you have 3 million souls all sitting there idle waiting to reincarnate? Let's go to Cambodia at this point. Like, it just actually, the numbers don't really work unless the so-called souls fragment or something.
Yeah, and I ask the Evergreens about that, or it comes up somewhere.
Mm.
There are like 10 billion souls.
Okay.
And so there were a lot of them that didn't reincarnate, you know, when there was only 2 million people on the planet.
Right.
There was a lot hanging around not reincarnating.
Right.
And so, but the Evergreens said that a lot of souls from Atlantis reincarnated in the 20th century. Yeah? So if we're going to live thousands of years, the 10 billion souls say, okay, you guys, all those from A to M, alphabetically, get the 20th century. And you also have had to have been in Atlantis.
Right.
And then they said the 21st century is going to have a lot of Lemurians come in, especially through Russia.
Hmm.
And it's going to be a different century with a different consciousness.
Hmm.
So, yes, they, you know, millions are coming in, but they're a subset of the billions.
Mm.
And the Evergreens said Ben Franklin hasn't reincarnated because I met his seventh generation daughter on the female side, and so we had a reading with their reason, spent an hour talking to Benjamin Franklin. He never reincarnated because he's been watching his baby, America, for 250 years. He's, you know, watching it evolve. He really identifies with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have lots. The souls can increase. We could have 6 billion people, but if there are 10 billion souls, the 4 billion is still not operating right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you come in phases. Okay, all those who were the time of Rome or something, they all reincarnate in one of the centuries coming to be. Or maybe they already did that in the 18th century.
Scott, you got any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I agree with all you guys, and I love hearing all the different perspectives and points of view, you know. I just enjoy soaking in it, and I certainly don't have the final answer. I can think of other scenarios. What about all potentially other planets out there and souls migrating between planets? That would complicate things even further.
A few hours ago, I asked Bob the same thing a few hours ago. Are we restricted to this solar system with our development? Because, you know, in the Rupert Sheldrake, that's what he was saying. You can't come back as a frog or spider because your aura is not the same. We've developed specific auras for our human creatures, and spiders have their own auras. So, yeah, the spiders come back as spiders and humans come back as humans if that happens.
Yeah, if it happens, and if you believe the Evergreens, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Humans don't. That the Indian religion, Hindu religion, is wrong. You know that
right. They come back as a pig in the next life for being a jerk.
Yeah.
Mind you, and the Kabbalah guys will say, if you incarnate and you're totally a really evil soul, and every time you incarnate you're a mass murderer or something just really evil or heinous, you will actually be infused into a stone, so that your soul will
The Kabbalah says that?
Yeah, you'll come back as a rock, or you'll be still, you'll be like kind of almost in a voodoo, they'll stick you on fucking Mars. You are now in this rock, and you stay there.
Okay, there's just 2 points. I want to address the alien thing, and then first of all, the Evergreens say there is no karma, and souls sort of do what they want, but most of them arrange something. They talk and have dialogue and set up a life pattern, and then they reincarnate and interact with those particular people. But souls can do what they want. Remember, they said that Hitler, he created his own hell on the astral plane.
Mm.
And
what do you mean he created his own hell on the astral plane?
After he died and sort of thought, well, maybe I better punish myself for what I did.
Right.
So he created a hell, and he put himself through some kind of tortures, and the Evergreens said that the astral plane or the group mind said, no, Hitler, that ain't enough. That's not good enough. You got to get your karmic sense of alleviating your guilt in the physical.
Right. So what's he reincarnated as?
Well, he hasn't reincarnated yet. And it sounds like that's what you got to do, but they couldn't force him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now about the aliens.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. You got to clean up karma on the level that you create it. So if you create karma on the astral plane, you got to clean it up there. If you create it on the physical plane, you got to clean it up there. Maybe, I don't know. But also, I think in the Blavatsky Theosophical tradition, they say that you can't be too judgmental of what humans do, because your soul has done all the trips. It's as a way of, finishing itself off. It's done all of them. But they also say that the personality that you are will continue on from if you're able to become the consciousness level of the soul that's at the center of it all, doing it all, then you may be detached from good and evil, but the part of you that is a personality will get hung up somewhere in the astral plane and get stuck trying to figure itself out for a very long time. And it's really, you know, you're seeing a reflection of yourself. So, you know, what the Beatles said, or John Lennon, or whatever, what the love you give is the love you take.
Mm-hmm. Paul McCartney, I think.
Paul McCartney, yeah.
Yeah. He wrote the whole second side of Abbey Road.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's good. That's interesting.
Well, except for Here Comes the Sun.
Now you're fading out really bad. I know.
I got the battery bloops going.
Yeah.
Sorry, so have I. But it'll end at some point, so don't worry. We'll just carry on. So you were impressed with the fact that Paul McCartney did the whole second side?
Except for Here Comes the Sun, obviously. That's
right.
George. But yeah, no.
You were impressed with that, Scott?
No, I didn't know that.
Side two of Abbey Road is Paul, basically.
Wow.
Are you impressed now? You said something, I missed it. Oh, wow.
I'm impressed by that fact, yeah.
Yeah.
But, of course, John Lennon was a creative giant and did,
absolutely,
you know, his own stuff, too.
Yeah. Can't deny the man.
Okay,
see, now you're fading out, too, Bob, but we may be coming to the end of this conversation.
Yeah. So let me get 2 points in, both the aliens. You were just saying that people, what? Karma?
Do aliens reincarnate?
No, the theosophical guys say it doesn't matter.
Right. So what, someone from a planet 100 light years away or a million light years away might end up reincarnating in this planet?
No, okay.
No.
Isn't that what you were saying, Scott? You quoted Blavatsky.
Yeah, but I was doing it on a couple of levels from the deepest level of the oversoul. It may not be caught up in issues of good and evil, but it's projections of you as a personality. Your personality, you may get hung up in your personality and end up having to live the consequences of, you know, seeing yourself in the cosmic mirror, depending on what you think about yourself and how you lived your life. In the Egyptian Book of the Dead, they say that, you know, if when you go before the judge, if your heart, you know, they put your heart on the scale and they put a feather on the other side of the scale, you know, but what you're really doing is seeing your own reflection and evaluating yourself, and then putting yourself into either a relatively cool place to be or a relatively not so cool place to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the Evergreens say that until we make contact with ETs, like the Boodians, on the astral plane, the souls of the Boodians do not have any contact with the souls of humans here on Earth.
Mm.
Which is interesting. It's like the astral plane is like a huge place, and they can keep people souls of awareness of each other. Not possible. You know, like they remain disconnected. That sounds weird.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what he said. And then once we make contact with the Boodians, you know, over the next 25 years, or what would be now next 15 years, we will then start to interact with them on the astral plane.
Yeah.
So, but imagine, who's keeping them apart? What's keeping them apart on the astral plane until we make the contact?
Well, this gets back to the discussion we had last week, that I touched on something that became clear for me, you know, when we talked with Robert Carr. You know, something that John Lilly hit on too, which is that, you know, there's this basic level of consciousness or awareness or self-awareness, and then, well, there's, you know, animals can be aware, and then they become a little more domesticated, they may become a little more self-aware, and then we get to the stage human beings become self-referential, and we see the world in terms of our perceptual matrix, and it's hard for us to see beyond our own self-referential closed system. So we wouldn't see those souls if they came up and bit us on the ass, because they're not part of our perceptual framework unless our perceptual framework gets a shock, like Gurdjieff used to say. If something shocks it, gets hit by lightning, which opens it up, but that can be dangerous because, you know, people become psychotic and crazy when they're flooded with perceptions that they don't understand. Mm-hmm. So there's this process of growth and merging that occurs, but it's an evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm. So what you were saying there...
So it would it would be a violation for them to just penetrate our reality. We may have defensive mechanisms which keep that from happening anyway.
Right, we couldn't see it.
Yeah.
Because when they do those photos in that book, Confirmation, the Whitley Strieber, he said when they run the video cameras, what they can go 10,000 frames a second, there's stuff that's all in there that'll happen for like 4 ten-thousandths of a second that'll look like a little like ancient sea creature swimming through the thing, or like a DNA strand with exhaust stuff. But that could be happening all the time, but we can't see it because it just flicks in and out at such a fast rate that our eyes aren't designed to detect it, and maybe almost kind of to sort of pick on what you're saying is maybe that's also a protective mechanism for us that we don't see this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say supposedly evergreens say you see all your lives when you're dead, all 3,000 lives approximately.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means you'd see your future lives when there was ET contact.
Mm-hmm.
So find it hard to figure out how you see all your lives and you're on an oversoul level and can see all kinds of ranges of experience you don't see when you're here. How does that awareness not make contact with an ET awareness, an ET soul?
Well, you know, I think if in the... by the way, I just want to say this for the recording, which was earlier I said you were fading out. I didn't realize I was holding, the way I was holding the phone to my head, I wasn't hearing you clearly, so actually everything is okay. In the Tibetan model, we have, you know, and John Lilly talked about all of the survival mechanisms which are built into our brain and nervous system just as a part of the evolutionary process of having to go through all the stages, when your consciousness begins to expand, these survival programs can get triggered off, and they can create fear reactions. Now, from the Tibetan perspective, when you drop the physical body, the first thing that happens is that you momentarily enter the clear light of objective reality, but most people are unable to stay awake in that state of consciousness. It's they're not accustomed to it, and it's just too outside their comfort zone, and so they go into a faint and
go into what? A faint.
Yeah, a faint, like
pass out.
Yeah, and start bouncing between frequencies, actually almost like frequencies of within the light spectrum, because the clear light gets shattered into its the clear light is actually above the speed of light, but then what's projected from the clear light is the white light, and then the white light gets fragmented into the seven colors of the spectrum, and what happens is that the being starts bouncing around between these different frequencies starts projecting can get based on what is referred to as the person's body of habits. What they project will either potentially frighten them or seduce them, and if they're able to maintain a sense of equanimity in that stage, they'll be able to pass through the visions, the seductive visions and the frightening visions, without being necessarily touched by those visions, and they'll pass back into the clear light. But to the degree that one's body of habits is such that one responds to either magnetically attracted to the seductive visions or fearfully repelled by the horrific visions, that energy starts to coagulate and condense and magnetize and pull one back down into denser and denser levels until one is reborn as a physical being. One can get, but there are actually six worlds that one can be reborn into in the Tibetan model, all of which are considered delusions because they all ultimately resolve into the objective clear light of reality. But the personality, the body of habits of the individual will determine, they'll ping pong around and end up being reborn into one of the six worlds.
Mm. You know, there's a woman who wrote a couple books. She was from Davis University, Recalling Past Lives, Howard Wabach or something. And the next one was Afterlives or something. And she said basically from putting people under hypnosis, most of them said when they died, their religious beliefs were confirmed. So if they believed in Jesus, then they were met. They sort of saw a Jesus person when they died. If they were into Buddha, they sort of saw a Buddha person. If they were into Hinduism, they sort of saw whatever they had would kind of ease them into the so-called, other reality kind of thing. And then I guess once they're there, then it gets smoothed over. But initially, because you talked about this almost shock when you're first dead, or something. So that's what she claims. People under hypnosis have said, oh, my religious beliefs were confirmed.
Right. And from the Tibetan perspective, Jesus and the Buddha and all of these guys are the same emanation of the clear light seen. We have this memory of how to get home, but we don't quite know how to get there, and so we project these guides. In the new age, people, they have their spirit guides, their higher self, their intuitive frequencies or whatever. These are all in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there are the friendly guides and the not-so-friendly guides. And they have to do with
friendly guides. They deceive you and go, yeah, here's where you want to go, and then you go there and it's a bad place.
Right, exactly.
Right.
But they're all
Christians worry about that too.
Yeah,
be deceived when they
right.
Decide.
But they're all the same guide, and the point is, when that light energy comes in, what do you project onto it? And if your survival program's kicked in and you project fear onto it, they become unfriendly guides.
Right.
And if your heart opens up when that energy comes in, they become friendly guides.
Right. Yeah.
But it's the same energy, and I think probably to a large degree, this world is established by the consensus of language, and probably these other heavenly worlds created by the Buddha and Jesus and all the rest of the thought forms of the human beings probably exist as places that you could become attracted to, but they all ultimately resolve back into the primal or fundamental intelligence which is bornless, eternal, and gives birth to all of these states of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Always amazing questions and things to consider, eh?
Yeah.
It's funny because there's a lot. I think 48% of the population describes itself now in Canada as atheist.
Hmm.
Interesting, eh? 48% of an ad campaign that's really bugging the local churches here.
Yeah.
If he's saying 40, I forget their slogan. They sound like it says 48% of the population doesn't believe there's a God. Is that good or bad, or is that really something to fear or not, or something? And the church is like actually trying to respond with almost the same kind of campaign, or something like to go. 48% of the people believe there's no God, and that's okay, or something. I forget exactly how they do it. It's an interesting thing because it's like you can't really argue with an atheist about these kind of things, because and then if you cite ghosts or sort of these kind of psychic phenomena or that, I'll go, well, show me one shred of proof, or if you say, Princeton University is confirmed, beyond statistical averages with certain people.
people in terms of, you know, whatever Zener cards or whatever. They go, that's bullshit. That isn't the case. I think there's probably a shitload of documented stuff. And most people you talk to will say they've had weird synchronicity or uncanny kind of events.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if someone doesn't want to believe, you can't convince them.
Yeah. And so...
I picked up Voices on Tapes. I played that for some friends who were atheists, and that really spooked the shit out of them. I noticed that. The minute they heard that, they're kind of like, they got that weird thing. I don't know if your liver or kidney releases adrenaline or something happens. But you know when they get that, the willies kind of thing?
Right.
It's funny. I've seen atheists get the willies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because if you take a strong stance, you know, I don't believe in God, you're covering up the fact that you're resisting that there might be God.
I know, it is a kind of a weird closed-mindedness, ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're really zealous about God and you're out there trying to convince everybody else that God is real, who are you trying to convince? Maybe you're really trying to convince yourself or overcome your own doubt that maybe there is no God.
Yeah, yeah.
So you take a strong position, and the other position automatically arises, and it becomes your shadow, you know, the thing that you're trying to keep hidden and convince everyone that's not true.
Yeah. So actually, funny, what we can almost say from that is that neither true believers nor atheists are rational.
Yeah. Yeah, and, yeah, and...
For me, like that woman's book, for instance, she did about 1,200 people, all the same questions. And one, she did not find karmic patterns, that you could be a real prick in one life, and then the next life you're not, and you're born in... That's a weird thing. She said she almost could not detect karmic patterns. And also that half the time you're a woman and half the time you're a man, and you switch races too, so it defeats any of the Aryan Hitler... Nazi mythology that, oh, if we can kill Jewish souls, that'll be good, then they won't be able to reincarnate into new bodies. Well, that's all bullshit, too, because,
right.
You know, the Nazis might come back as Jews in the next life. They don't even know it.
Right.
This is, and for me, her work is semi-scientific.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of good work being done in that area, especially, you know, now that medical science is able to revive people from the death state, you know, heart stops, brain flatlines, and they resuscitate the people out of these surgeries, and that's happening. There's so many hundreds of thousands of people that this is happening to now. They're really able to they're really doing some serious work on the near-death experience. I mean,
and
it's interesting.
People, like, demonstrating clairvoyance when they're near death?
Oh, yeah, they're out of body, hovering over the...
Describing what's going on.
Yeah, right, and or moving towards the light and seeing their loved ones, on the, you know, approaching them and
yeah. Now,
all this kind of stuff.
Now, the medical guy say that's a hallucination, right, that your body...
You know, there's more medical people coming on board because the evidence is becoming more and more clear because it's happening so much now. But it is, you can take whatever position you want. I mean, only 3 out of 10 people that die and are resuscitated remember having any kind of a near-death experience. And the other 8 out of 10 people say that, you know, it was just went into the dark void. There's nothing there.
Right. That's because I've known someone that I talked to recently, that same thing. They were on the operating table and were basically dead. And I said that, did you have any kind of, and he goes, no. Kind of, I mean, kind of shut down.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say, because maybe that person, well, you didn't experience a near-death thing, because you were still in your body, maybe. I don't know.
Or they did, and they couldn't translate it back into their brain through their belief system. But see,
that's true, too. In other words, they might not recollect what actually had happened.
I mean, they put you in a sleep lab, and they know everybody dreams at night, but very few people are able to bring back what they experienced in the dream state.
So true.
The brain and nervous system filters it all out.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, what's going on? Are you not in on this?
No, I'm interested in what you guys are saying.
Okay.
And then there's the thing that Bob brought up earlier, that it's the evergreens. If you rise to that level of the soul, from which, you know, 500 lifetimes are being extended like tentacles, and you get to the center of that, you see you've got like 500 lifetimes going on simultaneously.
Right. Well, and this woman that did the Helen Wabuck, that did all these 1,200 past life regressions on all these different people, she basically said it's like there's the super soul. It's like an apple tree, and every year the apple bears fruit. And then from those fruits also new seeds are born. But the thing is, the tree, the trunk of the tree actually has a memory. Oh, in 1917 it was a bad blight and I almost died. And then, oh, the next year was a good season, bumper crop. It has like the memory of all the lifetimes, whereas the apples that fall from each year, they only have the memory of their one lifetime.
Oh, yeah, that's a great analogy.
Not bad, eh?
Yeah.
That's what she concluded from all. She goes, I don't really have the answers, but what I can conclude from the answers that I got from doing all these past life regressions, that this makes the most sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really excellent book. I think that's in the mid-70s or something. Very, very, very good book.
Mm-hmm.
But she was originally just a regular psychologist, psychiatrist, mm-hmm. and then she had a weird deja vu experience. Mm-hmm. Had one of these Pioneer Village type exhibits, something in Oklahoma, and she was in the room, and she stood by the window, and she said, "Holy whoa!" She was overwhelmed with this feeling. I know this place. I've been here. And then she told it to a colleague. She goes, "I had this crazy thing," and this is like back in the '60s. And the colleague said, "Well, you know, have you heard of these past life regressions, hypnosis? You know, I know someone that does them. You want to go and try it?" So she said she had it done and found out that she was that girl, basically. And then later they found a book, and oh, there you go, there's the name. Yeah, you were that person.
Yeah.
And then she was so blown away by that, she's like, I want to just devote my time to figuring this out.
Right.
So she had the original credentials of 3 decades in the mainstream kind of thing, and then she went on this. So she carefully constructed a questionnaire and asked everyone the same thing. And she found out, like, no one was a prince or a king in their past life. Because, you know, if out of a billion people only one is a prince or king, then, you know, your chances are about 1 in a billion that you were. Most people were lower class, basically, and had shitty, drudgerous lives kind of thing. And she also found one of the worst places, times to be alive, was when the fall of the Roman Empire. A lot of people recall having very violent death, a lot of plunder and, you know, people coming through towns and just, you know, stabbing you and impaling you kind of thing as a breakdown of order.
Yeah. And then, and then there's the cool Bob McLuhan thing, which is that with the variety of media substances that we can take, like drugs now, the number of reality tunnels is multiplying as rapidly as the number of human beings are multiplying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can break away from the consensus herd mentality, and people can cultivate their own perceptions of the world they live in, and your perception can be, and your configuration of belief systems around all of this can be quite unique. You don't have to be in lockstep with the army, you know, or Ed Sullivan, everybody tunes into the same TV show at the same time mentality.
Yeah.
And then it gets into, you know, what these guys are talking about with the quantum mechanics and stuff like that. I mean, if you're creating unique personal perceptions, percepts of reality, different from mine, and we're breaking away from the collective and developing unique perceptions, and we're getting, and then we start taking quantum effects, Heisenberg effects, into account, to what degree are we beginning to create or co-create our experience of reality and move through in directions that are based more upon our imagination than upon the automatic routines that we've inherited from the past. where we just sort of automatically live the same Groundhog Day routine day after day after day. But now we're beginning to create the direction that we move in based on our own predilection.
Well, funny, the Kabbalah thing kind of goes in that, that your life is a cassette and it plays the same way until you change the cassette event, basically. By, like, you can go through a bunch of incarnations where you go, yes, 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 and finally, you finally go, no. And by doing that, you change your cassette tape, and then your next lifetimes are altered. That's their belief, but that's not confirmed, for instance, by that woman research and doing the past life regression. She said she couldn't find karmic patterns or links between lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I still don't believe in being a dirty, rotten bastard. If
no.
You get punished for it.
No, but there is, you know, in the occult tradition, like if you get into all the Golden Dawn stuff and the Blavatsky stuff and everything, there's the Dark Brotherhood and the Light Brotherhood. And for
right.
some reason, some people think they can get back to the source by going through the Dark Brotherhood, the chaotic path home. But it looks like a hard road to hoe to me to want to do it that way.
Yeah.
But some people are pretty committed to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's odd, eh?
Yeah.
Bob, what's going on, man? You're sitting there. What are you doing?
I'm just listening to you guys. I think this is a good way to end it. The grasping for straws on the eschatological level. Is there life before death?
Well, if there's life after death, then you would assume it would be before there, too, right?
Not the way it looks today.
No, what do you mean?
Well, a lot of people feel that it's a dead existence.
Right. But I'm saying if anyone accepts, like, say, Christians, that there's life after death, right, then it would be just as logical to assume and then there must have been something before then, too.
Yeah, no, I'm just quoting the old McLuhan joke. He was asked if there's life after death. He said, well, what is there life before death?
Right.
Which is maybe never said by anybody before him. Mm. So I was just quoting that.
Oh, yeah. No, from some spirit, some, quote, spirit-type perspectives, this physical world is the world of, you know, is the world of the walking dead, the sleeping machines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the Gurdjieff.
You have the other thing that says that we created this plane so that we could experience being in bodies and experience change, because you can't experience that when you're not in this plane.
Yeah, that's what the Evergreens say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I had, in my younger days, the experience of entering into sort of an eternal space, you know, using substances and such, and it wasn't very pleasant because I wasn't really in a state that I wanted to be in an eternal state in my condition at that time. So there's a certain, I think we want to have gotten ourselves to a pretty good space before we want to enter the
right.
eternity.
Yeah. Well, as I think in a lot of religion does, it tries to psychologically prepare people for death.
Yeah.
Doesn't it, eh? Wouldn't you say, Bob?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that, Dave? What prepares?
Religion tries to psychologically prepare people to die.
And that may be the most important mission.
Yeah. There's, you know, that I never tried it. There's that drug, it was legal, called Salvia, that they were literally selling in, like, variety stores. They recently... They didn't ban it, but they've withdrawn it from the stores pending legislation. And apparently that, when you smoke it, this one guy I know who loves doing everything from ecstasy to any drugs he'll take, crack, you give him anything. And he said he took that and he absolutely hated it. He said it felt like someone was stepping on my soul. In fact,
yeah.
If you go online, I think on YouTube, there's even a video coming. I can drive a car on Salvia because it just, like, totally disorientates you. And the guy in that magazine, he wrote an article. He did, I said, because you can go down to the local store and just buy it, and, you know, for cheap. It's like a leaf, and you smoke it, and apparently makes you feel like you're dead, and it's really bizarre feeling and totally disorientating, and it's bizarre. Even, like, people like doing drugs go, I don't really like doing that one. That's a weird feeling. It lasts about 10 minutes, apparently.
And it's legal.
Yeah, but what they've done is, like, because I was amazed, they were selling in variety stores. Like, holy shit, like, this is weird. Like, have you ever gotten your car and, like, took a off of that, you'd have a car accident. Is they even though they haven't made it illegal yet, they've taken it out of the stores saying pending legislation. That's how they can kind of do it. Until we resolve whether this should be a banned substance, you can't sell it.
Mm.
So that's what they've kind of done. But the way that my one friend described it, he said, it's horrible. He felt like someone was extinguishing, was like stepping on his soul, and there wasn't anything he could do about it. Strange, eh?
Yeah.
Have you heard of that stuff there, Scott?
Yeah, Terrence talked about that. I'm pretty sure that's the one. And he tried it once, and that was enough for him. You know,
God, it was just a kind of really...
He felt obligated to try everything at least once, because his whole... that was his mission in life, was to explore what drugs do to the human nervous system and what the potential states of consciousness could arise from. And that one was wicked.
That's what he thought.
It yeah.
Just pretty crazy, just overwhelming, not something you'd want to do a lot.
Yeah.
Why is it available? How come?
Because they never pass any laws. So, you know, it's easy to grow, and they're like, hey, let's package us and sell us if they say we can. And then so kids were doing it, and then eventually people were like, well, how can you sell us at variety stores? Just like, you know, little Max Milky kind of store. There's a privately run variety stores. I never did it. And then people would say, why don't you try it? I'm like, no, I read the article and that, and I was like, I don't want to feel that at all. I don't even want to try it. That's just me. Maybe I'm a little closed-minded, but I've tried other drugs, but not that one did not appeal to me at all. Maybe if I was 12 or 13 years old, I might want to do it, but not at my age.
Okay, well, we should end on that.
That's not a good ending.
Oh yeah, Bob. We don't know about your drug experiences.
Well, I was just going to say that it's a good ending because that's the dilemma in the future. What drug am I going to take?
In the future.
Yeah, like, you know, Brave New World, Soma. What drug will I take to stimulate me, since as I go more cyborg?
Yeah, you personally, or just...
No, for humanity.
Humanity, right.
Brain stimulants. Because, you know, books, movies are brain stimulants, but pretty soon, why not just take a little bit of substance, which has a particular effect?
I know, but you sort of need some cultural input, don't you? You can't just be a blank slate and experience just archetypes of the past few thousand years without having any sense of who you are, who you would think. Or it's hard for me to get my head around that, being a blank vessel and then taking an external drug that just suddenly makes you experience things. You first have to live and have some cultural background of some sort to have some basis to work with.
I guess that's why they're arguing today about what's going to be the New World Order. What is the content of it? What's going to be the culture of dominance, which would be the framework that everybody grows up in, and then they can spin off with drugs and hallucinate on that,
right.
That foundation.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, my personal preference, you know, I think that marijuana and magic psilocybin, magic mushrooms are something that, you know, have their benefits and usefulness to people, and that I think a lot of people can benefit from those drugs that more so than if they never took them, that it does give them alternate perspectives, and I think that's healthy for some people to have. That's just me personally.
Well, let's end with that phrase. It's just me personally. It's the metaphysical isolation. I don't know, that's Scott.
No, Bob, thanks for sponsoring this discussion. Dave, it's a pleasure to meet you tonight on the phone. Very much enjoyed being able to cohabitate in the discarded state with you.
Yeah, it felt good.
Yeah.
Awesome, Scott. Well, thank you also for all the hard work you do and your enthusiasm for Bob.
Well, my pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Awesome. Well, good luck. Hopefully that you don't get crushed in the juggernaut economy thing that's happening.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, what's going to happen when the Dow goes to zero?
Yeah, it's likely to happen.
It is weird, isn't it? This is unprecedented.
Yeah. You know, money is disappearing as a medium of exchange, and how are people going to cope with that? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that Bob addresses on the Cash Flow Show.
Right. Or you could possibly do it on number 67, his show 67.
Right. Well, let's just sign off. It's today we started on the 23rd, but today's right now is February 24th at 1:26 a.m. Signing off for now.